Okay, just, you know, Imen Kemachin Torah. So I want to start by thanking really our sponsors of the whole program. The Emerson family right over here, the Schiff family over there, and the Lacks family probably in the other lecture. So I really want to thank the three of them for underwriting the program, for all their help over the years, and not only in a financial way, but in the moral support all of them offer and their interest in what we do. And I want to thank them, and we should all thank them. It's a pleasure to introduce, I guess, you know, someone I see every week almost on computer on Monday evenings on E-Team, really, the fascinating talk that Mark gives on Gedolei Yisrael. They're really amazing. There are, I think, over 50 of them. You can go to the on the Torah Motion website. You can download them from Rav Avadya Yosef to Satmar Rebbe, Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Cook, you name it. The entire range, they're really quite fascinating, you know, talks. He just started his last series this past Monday night, so that's at 9 p.m. on Mondays. You'll see him on computer. You can talk to him and see him and type to him. But now we wanted to bring him in flesh and blood to feel him in Toronto, so it's really a pleasure to have him. Dr. Shapiro is the Weinberg Chair at University of Scranton, and he also is a graduate of Harvard University with a PhD, the last person to get a PhD with the late Isidore Chorsky, and really he's a top-notch scholar, I'm sure everybody, that's why you're all here. We do have the four books he has written recently. They're all on sale at a huge discount. The PhD thesis on Rabbi Weinberg, you know, Shaul Lieberman on the Orthodox, his book that hot off the press on the Rambam, very fascinating, of course, the book, we'll just leave it, on Orthodox theology, on the Yud Gimel Ikar and the Rambam. They're all fascinating. I've read them all. I highly recommend them. And without further ado, Dr. Mark Shapiro. Go to about 12:25.
Okay, thank you. The topic is, and once again, it's a pleasure to be here, see many people I've known from the past, old friends. The topic is Samson Raphael Hirsch and Orthodoxy, a Contested Legacy. And my question is, how did the Orthodox relate to Hirsch in the years after his death, including to our own day? Now, on the one hand, Hirsch saved German Orthodoxy, or at least so it was thought. Now, this would entitle him to a great deal of respect. On the other hand, his philosophy of Torim Derech Eretz, which requires Jews to be part of Western civilization, to bring the insights of Torah to bear on life in the modern world, was diametrically opposed to East European Orthodoxy, which believed in separating as much as possible from the non-Jewish world. The Chatam Sofer, the great Chatam Sofer, thought that emancipation was a bad thing, that it's better for Jews to be in a ghetto and subject to certain disabilities where they can have a complete Jewish life rather than be emancipated, which will lead to assimilation and all sorts of problems as we see in our own day and age. Hirsch, however, had a very different position. He saw the ghetto as something that we were put in against our will. And we don't want to be in the ghetto. The greatest Kiddush Hashem is to have a Jewish doctor or government worker. Our mission, and he actually uses this notion, which most people only associate with the Reform, our mission is to bring the insights of Torah to the world at large, not to be put inside a ghetto. Now, until World War II, German Orthodoxy was really separate from the East. It's true that you had numerous East European Jews living in Germany. They came and life was better in Germany, but they were not integrated. They were really as guests. Now, in the pre-war years, Hirsch was not understood by all, certainly not in the East, but they always gave him a great deal of respect. Unlike Hildesheimer, Israel Hildesheimer, the other great German Orthodox rabbi, he went to Hungary and he tried to change Orthodoxy there. He opened a modern yeshiva and he created a lot of controversy. Hirsch had no interest in doing anything outside of his borders. So unlike Hildesheimer, who was vilified and attacked by the extremists in Hungary, Hirsch was always treated with great respect. And we have this even among Hasidic leaders. When the Ger Rebbe, Rav Avraham Mordechai Alter, was asked about Hirsch's Torim Derech Eretz program, he was asked by Rabbi Schwab, should we still continue with it? He was careful to say that it's not our approach, but we must be careful not to criticize Hirsch, who was a great tzaddik. Even the extremist, Rav Chaim Elazar Shapiro, the Rebbe of Munkach, who had negative things to say about all modern manifestations, including Agudas Yisrael. He was the biggest enemy of that. When it came to the German Orthodox approach of Hirsch, he said, we have to view it like the Parah Aduma. That is, if it was in our countries, it would make the pure impure, but in Germany, it makes the impure pure. So he has positive things to say about Hirsch's approach, but only in Germany. There's also a famous story, which, while not speaking of Hirsch per se, gives you a sense of the way the East European greats viewed the German Orthodox. It's actually with regard to Hildesheimer. Yisrael Salanter was in Germany, and he saw Hildesheimer giving a shiur to women. And he said, if he would do that in the East, they'd throw him out, and they should throw him out. But I only wish that my share in the world to come is the equal of Israel Hildesheimer. Again, a recognition that in Germany, things have to be a little different. But this admiration of the German Orthodox, in particular of Hirsch, was not always accompanied by actual knowledge of what they were doing. One of the most famous examples of this is the great Rav Baruch Ber Leibovich, one of the great Rosh Yeshiva of Eastern Europe, Kamenetz, a great student of Chaim Soloveitchik before the war. He went so far as to say that Hirsch's entire program of Torim Derech Eretz, of Torah involved with civilization, was only an emergency measure, Hora'at Shah. That is, Jews of Germany were suffering assimilation, all that, and therefore, as an emergency measure to try to save the remnant, therefore we do that. But he never meant it as a lechachila, as something that's positive in and of itself. Now, Baruch Ber could say that because he didn't read German. He never read anything Hirsch wrote. He just assumes that, how could anyone think that there's a positive value of being part of Western civilization? Now, this actually becomes the great myth, as we'll see, of Hirsch in the Haredi world. And it's a fascinating topic. There's a great deal that can be said about this, and I want to focus on more recent times, how Hirsch has been viewed in both the Haredi world and in the religious Zionist world, because they each have their problems with Hirsch, but for different reasons. So let me start with the Haredi. The first thing to notice is that Hirsch has entered the pantheon of Haredi Gedolim. Although he is not known for his writings on Talmud and Halacha, although he was learned and he wrote on them, all you have to do is look at his commentary to Vayikra and you see how knowledgeable he was. That's not what he's known for. He's known for his writings on Jewish philosophy and his commentaries on Chumash, on Tehillim. He has been let into the pantheon of Haredi Gedolim, though, and this isn't just done as a favor to the German Orthodox Jews who joined the Aguda. He is a full-fledged member of the fraternity, and the greatest proof of this is the fact that he has a biography from Art Scroll. And if you get a biography of Art Scroll, although a friend of mine points out, I'm not 100% sure, but if you look at the famous picture of Hirsch that appears as it is, and then the one that appears of him on the cover of the Art Scroll biography, he seems to have a fuller beard. I mean, he does have a fuller beard, whether it's intentional or whether when they turned it into like a picture, like a painting-type picture, I'm not sure. In fact, due to his acceptance in the Haredi world, it is not even PC anymore to call him Hirsch. He has to be referred to as Rav Hirsch. You even go to modern Orthodox conferences, it's always Rav Hirsch this, Rav Hirsch that. That's interesting, because even in Germany, his greatest followers never referred to him as Rav Hirsch. He was always Hirsch in the German Orthodox. But today, it's become unacceptable to refer to him as Hirsch in many circles, so it's always Rav Hirsch. Just as with the American Haredi community, the Israeli Haredim have accepted Hirsch. On the one hand, this is understandable. His family were part and parcel of Agudas Yisrael. They founded Agudas Yisrael, and many of them remained so when they went on Aliyah. In fact, it wasn't until the 1960s that Professor Mordechai Breuer, the great-grandson of Hirsch, the grandson of Shlomo Zalman Breuer, one of the founders of Aguda, it wasn't until the mid-60s that he published an open letter saying that there no longer is any place for German Jews in Aguda. He describes how at the beginning we were there throughout all the early conferences. It was always understood that German Orthodoxy is a valid approach, and Eastern European is a valid approach, but by the 1960s, he says there no longer is any place for German Orthodoxy. Agudas Yisrael, the Moetzes Gedolei Torah, no longer recognizes our lifestyle as valid. And that led to German Orthodox Jews with Poalei Agudas Yisrael or Mizrahi. Now, it was not a matter, though, of the Israeli Agudas Yisrael simply rejecting the Hirschian ideology. Matters were more complicated than this, because they also, just like in America, wanted to introduce Hirsch into the pantheon of Israeli Gedolim. If you look in the Art Scroll biography, it's very clear that Torim Derech Eretz is a lechatchila, and they don't make any bones about that. But in Israel, matters were more complicated. And as I said, there were many German Orthodox Jews who were part of the Aguda, so you couldn't keep this sage out. On the other hand, how can you put Hirsch in when his ideology of Torim Derech Eretz is diametrically opposed to the Haredi position in the land of Israel? Before even looking at this, though, and what they did, it's important to remember that there were two other aspects of Hirsch's ideology that were crucial for the Haredi community. If it was just Torim Derech Eretz, Hirsch never would have been in. However, he also had a concept of Austrit, separatism, that I'll be speaking about in the next session, namely that you have to separate yourself as much as possible from the non-Orthodox movements. And these were the two bases of his ideology, Torim Derech Eretz and Austrit, and they go together. Fundamentally, they go together, as we'll explain in the next lecture. Now, it's true that the Aguda in Israel never adopted a policy of complete Austrit. There never was an idea that we should live like the Neturei Karta, separate ourselves entirely. That's why the so-called Eda Haredit broke with the Aguda. The Eda Haredit was actually the leader of Agudas Yisrael through the 30s in Eretz Yisrael. And then it just became impossible, because if you want to be involved in building up the land and making it a Torah society, you can't be separated. Yet the ideology as such was useful, even if you're paying taxes, so you're in Israeli society, but you still can separate as much as physically possible. That becomes very important to Haredim. Second, Hirsch was an anti-Zionist. Hirsch, and it continues in his circles, many of them, did not believe in either settling the land of Israel en masse or establishing a state before the coming of the Messiah. So these two aspects were very important to the Haredi. But what then to do about the third aspect, Torim Derech Eretz? It's not like it could be ignored, because a project began in the 1940s of translating Hirsch into Hebrew. In addition, there were other comments of Hirsch's writings that would create great problems. One thinks of the 19 letters. In the 19 letters, Hirsch engages in very sharp criticism of the Rambam, accusing him of watering down Judaism to bring it into line with Greek ideas. Can you put someone in your pantheon of Gedolim who speaks this way about the Rambam? Now, the 19 letters appeared in Hebrew, a complete version in 1891, with the Haskamas of Gedolim. But then in 1948, a new translation was published. We'll look at it in a minute. And one sentence is omitted, just one sentence, this sentence, quote, "Is Moses the son of Maimon, or Moses the son of Mendel, that is Mendelssohn, really identical with Moses the son of Amram?" Okay, he's asking a question. After putting forth Rambam's philosophy and the problems with it, he says, after seeing this, is the Rambam's ideas really identical with Moses' ideas? Now, this was thought to be too strong an attack against the Rambam. But we know the publishers didn't take this step on their own. The publisher, his name was Avraham Wolf. He was a German Orthodox Jew who became very close to the Chazon Ish. After the Chazon Ish's death, he told this story. He went to the Chazon Ish and he said he's translating the writings into Hebrew, but he has a problem with this. And he said especially that Hirsch never again returned to this harsh criticism of the Rambam. So do we have to leave it in? Especially, he also said to the Chazon Ish that in Hirsch's day, the reformers were citing the Rambam as basis for their ideas, that, you know, the Rambam explains kashrus as due to health reasons, and today we don't have to worry about that. So in those days, it was a danger. And he felt, Wolf says to the Chazon Ish, you know, Hirsch needed to deflate the Rambam's significance. Maybe today we don't need to leave these in. And the Chazon Ish told him, you're absolutely right, you should take this out, and if anyone challenges you, you tell them that I said you could take them out. But that's all that was taken out, that one sentence. When the work was reprinted in the late 1960s, it was felt that more of Hirsch's ideas need to be taken out. And thus three paragraphs were completely cut out. I showed you this in the past once, some of you might remember, but I just want to show you again. If you turn, there's two pages, you have two copies here. If not, we have extras up here. One says Igrot Safon, actually, Otsat Netzach, and the other just has the date. Tufshin Chet. So we should have made different colors. It would have been easier. I forgot. But if you open up the one that on the front says the date, Tufshin Chet, it says page 92 on the top. Does anyone not have that one? There's some here. You see, there's a paragraph there that says Tufshin Fahati. You see on page 92? No, it's coming around here. Where is that? Yeah, right there. Over here. Okay, you see it? Okay. compromises as he sees it with Greek philosophy. Now I want you to open up the page where it says it doesn't have a page number, it just says Osaka Metzah. These are here, and we'll be good here. And I want you to compare. On the other one, open up the page where it says Cook Dao and Cook Pei. Remind you next time I have some different colors, it makes it easier. So one of them, you see it says page 92 and 93. And where it says page 92, the second full paragraph, Atsufa. Then you look at the one where it says pages Cook Dao and Cook Pei. Look in the second column. The first full paragraph ends, the last word is lipuo. That corresponds to the word lipuo on page 92. And then you have three whole paragraphs just cut out. And the next paragraph begins hashtaho. And the only clue that something is amiss is that you notice the space between the two paragraphs is a little bit too big. And also, if you look carefully, in the first page, page 93, after summarizing what's wrong with Hirsch, it says, that these hashkafot were problematic, but since these have just been cut out, we can't say that. So instead, it has to become hashkafot mosuyemot, certain hashkafot. And look, the word, it's a little bit small, we can't really see very well, but if you take a magnifying glass, you'll see that they've taken the words hashkafot mosuyemot, they're not exactly the right size. So just cut it out!
So the reader of the 18 letters in Hebrew, and this is the only translation available today as far as I know, the second one, will have no idea of the Rambam's, the harsh attack on the Rambam found by Hirsch. And they also carried out other examples of censorship. For example, Hirsch speaks about Kabbalah. He's not an opponent of Kabbalah, but he sees Kabbalah very differently, and he criticizes the way Kabbalah is used in his day, not as a form of theosophy of understanding God, but a form of like a magical that you can influence the world. You know, like he criticized the Hasidic approach to Kabbalah. That's also entirely cut out. In fact, in an amazing example of censorship by this publisher, Mordechai Berger pointed out that a comment that Hirsch makes in which he praises Torah and Derech Eretz, that's cut out. Now, we've certainly squared the circle when you take Hirsch's major feature, Torah and Derech Eretz, and take it out. But as I said, this notion that Torah and Derech Eretz, the myth, that it was only a time-bound thing, that becomes the central myth of how Haredim understand Hirsch. And in Netzach, this is a Haredi publisher that translated German Orthodox writings, they quote Rav Baruch Ber Leibovitz as this is how Hirsch is to be understood. And it's not just Rav Baruch Ber, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, the previous one, Rav Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, he says the same thing, that Hirsch's approach is only a Harat Shah. So therefore, I don't think it should surprise any of you that in the collected translation of Hirsch's writings that appeared in English, seven volumes, actually it's a nice translation, it has all the Torah and Derech Eretz stuff, it even has his essay called The Importance of Secular Studies for Torah Judaism, or something like that, in which he talks about how valuable secular studies are, not for utilitarian purposes. And anyone who thinks that you study secular studies for utilitarian, to help you get a job, etc., you're missing the whole significance of it. They too felt they had to leave out one important essay. Hirsch, on the anniversary of Schiller's birth, there was a festival at his school in honor of Schiller, and Hirsch gave a whole talk about the beauty of Schiller and why it's so significant. It will appear by myself, translated in the next Torah Mada journal, but this is really the only important piece of Hirsch's writings that has never before been translated into Hebrew or English, where you see in practice what it means to take the culture of the Gentile society. Now, I understand why today it's very weird to be speaking this way about a German poet and all, but this was Hirsch. He was a cult figure of sorts. And I could give you many more examples of how this has been done. In a recent journal, someone goes so far as to claim, Hamayah on the journal, that Hirsch only permitted the study of secular subjects so that you learn German, so that you can get a decent job. But he didn't want you to pay attention to what's written there. I mean, incredible claims have been made. And let me read you something that appeared in the Netzach translation as publisher, a note to one of Hirsch's essays in which he speaks about the dignity of work, the value of labor, you know, the Torah and Derech Eretz, being part of civilization. I'll translate it here. I mean, this passage, which they have the note on, Hirsch talks about that you don't only serve God through study of Torah. You don't need to sit and study Torah all day. You know, you serve God through work and every everything you do. And that labor is valuable, not just because you're making a living, but because it builds character. The Torah wants you to live in the world. You know, all the sources, etc. This is the translation of the note. These words of Hirsch, or of Samson for Hirsch, you have to understand in the context of his times. He said these things to save the youth that had become distant from Torah, or their parents had distanced from Torah, and they were just about in the arms of the Haskalah and assimilation. Lo kein ha'idna, not so today, where we have been worthy to have a different youthful generation whose soul yearns for Torah, uv'miskeret ha'yeshivatit dafka, and only within the walls of the yeshiva. And many, many parents, their entire desire is to see their children grow in Torah and faith. And there are many young women, who place upon themselves the duty of supporting the family. And there are many women today who are happy to support their husbands while they do that. Now that's the yeshiva approach, that's fine. But that's certainly not Hirsch's approach, but they have to put it in. Dafka to say that don't assume what Hirsch is saying, that there's dignity in work, that it's a positive thing. That doesn't apply today. It doesn't apply when there are women who are willing to go out there and work and support you so you can stay in the yeshiva. Now, I heard a good joke. Supposedly it's a true story, but I don't believe it. This Rosh Yeshiva came into one of the Beis Yaakovs in Brooklyn to try to convince the girls how important it is you have to marry someone who's only going to learn in Kol, etc. Chas v'shalom, they were saying, you know, that you're going to have the mila of supporting your husband, etc. So a smart girl raises her hand and says, Rebbe, I don't understand. You know, we read in Bereishis that after Chava's sin, we have a punishment, that we have to give birth a curse in pain. But why are you giving us the man's curse? The man's curse was he has to go out and work hard, and now we have two curses. So it's a good question, but another example relates to Hirsch's famous letter dealing with the binding authority of Agadic literature. Hirsch was asked what to do about these passages in the Talmud that the rabbis give, they speak about scientific matters, and we know scientifically it's not correct. And Hirsch argued that the rabbis were interested in Torah learning. So if it says, if some Greek traveler records in his work that there's, let's say, an animal who's half man, half beast, Chazal, they don't know what's going on over there. They assume this guy knows the truth, and therefore they want to then clarify the halachic issues. No different than it today. If you told a posek that there's some sort of thing out there, some sort of medicine, he'll then look at the halachic angle of it. It's not his job to figure out. He takes the facts as they're given to him, and that's how Hirsch explains things in the Agadah, medical things which you know aren't true. Their job was to learn Torah, and whatever the facts are, and if you get new facts, then they analyze the new facts. And there's a whole tradition of this, dating from the Gaonim, that in Agadic literature, much of it is that sort. It's tentative, it's conjecture, it's not Misinai. And Hirsch was asked about this, and he explained this in detail. When the volume of Hirsch's writings in Hebrew was published, Shemesh Marpeh, the responsa, all the other letters are included. This is not included. And a professor who writes about it, he asked Rabbi Schwab from the Washington Heights community, who funded this work, why these letters weren't included. There are two letters of Hirsch. And let me read from it. In my memorable phone conversation with Rabbi Simon Schwab, our conversation at one point turned to the recent important collection of writings of Rabbi Hirsch, Shemesh Marpeh. I took the opportunity to express my surprise that these two letters of Rabbi Hirsch to Rabbi Wexler were not included in the volume, which purports to include all of Rabbi Hirsch's major Hebrew writings. Rabbi Hirsch did not write much in Hebrew, but these were written in Hebrew. Rabbi Schwab replied, and I am citing him practically verbatim, "Yes, you are correct. The editor consulted with me, and I advised him not to publish them. I told him that the letters are controversial and likely to be misunderstood, and that his publishing them would just bring him unnecessary grief." Tsaris. Schwab was concerned about controversy in the Haredi world, and we see that he was on to something, because when Slifkin started publishing his stuff and citing Hirsch as his authority, a huge controversy broke out, and an attempt has been made in recent years, without merit, even impugn the authenticity of these letters. Since Hirsch is in the pantheon of the Haredi Gedolim, it is impossible for him to be there and express views which are so much in opposition to the Haredi Das Torah. And this, again, was much in the news with the Sifkin affair. What to do, though, by the fact that you have these letters? Well, Rav Moshe Shapiro, there's an important Rav in Israel. He's like an ideological gadol. You have different types of gadolim. You have gadolim who are in poskim and shas. He's more of a Rav Dessler type spiritual leader. He declared that the letters are forgeries, based on the fact that we don't have copies of the original letters. On the other hand, we do have the original letters of the rabbi who wrote to Hirsch, in which he cites what Hirsch wrote to him, and we do have the copies Hirsch made for himself, or his children made for him. So, I mean, you don't need much more than that. And, well, you can't really deny that, you can't reject Hirsch. You can keep Hirsch in the Haredi world if you have this, so what do? You can't cover up his views. You can't censor them like we saw in Netzach, since they're all over the world. They've been published numerous times in English and Hebrew. The next best thing to do, then, is to declare them as forgeries. Just as a censor, just as Netzach knew what Hirsch said, but they thought it was important for the world not to know, so too Rabbi Shapiro, I am no doubt, he knows what Hirsch said. How could he not know? But just as the censor knows the truth, but for ideological purposes covers it up, he declares that these are forgeries, knowing that they're not forgeries, but this is part of a public service so that the people not be led astray. One more example of censorship with regard to Hirsch, before we move on to the Rav Kook school, is seen with regard to head coverings. While today the idea of men covering their heads, other than the Syrian community, is pretty standard, the traditional approach, at least the most post-scheme, is that it's only a minhag, and it's now become obviously something we do. But in Germany, they didn't do it. In Germany, you didn't wear a kippah. In fact, I have a great picture, I could send it to anyone who wants, of people from the Frankfurt community outside before a wedding. They took pictures. All the women are wearing shadels. They were very makpid in Frankfurt on shadels. And all the men, some of them even have beards, none of them wearing yarmulkes. So it's a great wedding picture. But in Germany, they did not wear kippot outside. They did not wear kippot at university. They wore it in the house, but not always. We have many examples where they did not wear it in the house, just for davening and eating if you make a bracha. Someone even told me a story where he went to ask the Rav of Shiloh, and the Rav came to the door without a yarmulke on. That was the minhag. And I discussed this at length at other occasions. The problem is that today pasnish doesn't work, doesn't fit. Now, we have these pages here, Melamed al-Hawil. These are the responses of Rav David Zvi Hoffman. Let me tell you about, David Zvi Hoffman was the most important posek in Germany in the early 20th century, and he has a responsum in which he talks about how when he came to Hirsch's school, they didn't wear, and he just says, as a matter of fact, he's telling you a story, how in her, because the question he was asked is, if you have to take an oath in court, do you have to cover your head? Because obviously if you're in court, you wouldn't be wearing a kippah. And he tells that our practice in Germany is not to wear a yarmulke. At Hirsch's school, for the secular subjects, they didn't wear a kippot. And if you know how much Torah study in Hirsch's school, they didn't have that much Torah study. It wasn't like today. Most of the day, they sat bareheaded. So he's telling us that in Hirsch's school, they sat bareheaded. And then he tells us that when he went to see Hirsch, when he first got there to his office, Hirsch told him, next time you come to my office, take off your head covering, because the non-Jewish teachers will see you coming into the office with the head cover without your head uncovered, and they'll think it's disrespectful. So this is amazing testimony of what it was like in the school. I asked Professor Mordechai Breuer before he passed away about this, and he wrote to me as follows, and I put this on the Sfarim blog. I left the Hirsch school in Frankfurt in 1934. I wanted to know if this was just a 19th century thing or if this idea of uncovered heads continued into the 20th century. The rule of uncovered heads while studying secular subjects was enforced without exception. Then he goes to say the only people it was not enforced upon were rabbis. You had community rabbis who also taught at the school. That if you were a rabbi, if you had smicha, it didn't matter, you have to uncover your head. But if you were the rav of a shul and you also taught secular subjects, in the Hirschian school, it was very important. They wanted non-Jews or from Jews to teach classes like math. They didn't want non-religious Jews. So if you were a community rabbi and you were also teaching math, as the rav, you always wore your head covered for the most part. However, during the last years of the school's functioning, when the impact of the Nazi regime became increasingly palpable, pupils and teachers reacted by covering their heads in secular subjects as well. It was a form of rebellion. Part of German society was not to cover your head, but now that they're being kicked out of German society, they began to. Now, this appears in the Melamed al-Hawil. This is one of the most important works of Psak in the 20th century. And at the end of the 20th century, they began a group in Israel started reprinting cheaply for Yeshiva Brachim all the important Svarim. It's called the Kess Leibowitz edition. And something very interesting happened. Turn to the first page. You have a table of contents. I want you to look under second column, Hilchos Avodas Chachamim. You see Siman Nun Hey. And then the next Siman is Siman Nun Zion. It's already there. First is Siman Nun Hey, and then Siman Nun Zion. So already there, you see something strange going on. But okay, if that's what all there is, no one would notice. But turn to the next page. The entire responsum is missing. And I believe this is very counterproductive, because if they just left the responsum in, and let's say maybe took out the table of contents, no one would notice. I guarantee you, anyone who gets this book and is going through it and sees this is going to want to know what's missing. You know, it wasn't reset. Usually when you censor, it's a new typeset, no one knows the difference. And sometimes if you're lucky, the responsum appears on one page, so you just cut that out. But this you couldn't do. It was cheap, it was photo offset. Anyone who sees this, it will defeat the whole purpose. You're going to want to know what's missing here. And but this is, they don't want people to know about this. Okay, now I want to talk about, in the time we have left, one more thing, not to belabor the point, but since we're on head coverings, and we're speaking about Hirsch, I should mention his grandson, the great theoretician of the Aguda, Isaac Breuer. Look in the last page of one of the handouts, the one that looks like this. You see this picture, everyone? This is a classic, famous picture of Isaac Breuer. This is in the page. No Yarmulke, the great theoretician. When the picture was later republished, here you go. Draws the Yarmulke on him. Because, again, today, if you want to make him an important figure, you can't have him looking like this without a Yarmulke, even though in the German Orthodox world, that's the way you lived. So you just draw it on. This was done with the Lubavitch Rebbe. This has been done for many people. It's a distortion of the past, but we understand why. Okay, the school of Rav Kook has its own problems with Hirsch. While the Haredim want to make him a gadol for their communities and have to deal with his advocacy of Torah Derech Eretz, the followers of Rav Kook assume that he is a great authority, and therefore they need to reduce his significance, make him less of an authority, in order to pull the wool from beneath his two major views, Austrit. They're not so exercised by anti-Zionism. Why? Because there's many gadolim much greater than Hirsch who are anti-Zionists, so you can deal with them. That's not where Hirsch has been significant. Hirsch has been significant with regard to Austrit. The principle of Austrit, which, as we'll talk about next lecture, which is, as we said, a major aspect of his ideology, which also became an aspect of the ideology of the Aguda in Israel with the Eidah Haredit, and later, although not officially, they always had this approach, was strongly opposed by Rav Kook. Rav Kook even says that the desire to separate from other Jews stems from idolatry, and it's a Maisa Amalek. He says it comes from Kefira in the uniqueness of the Jewish people. They can't be separated. In fact, this comment that it's Maisa Amalek was so strong that Ratzvi Yehuda Kook, when he published Rav Kook's writings, censored it. Ratzvi Yehuda censored it because he thought that the generation is not ready to hear such strong comments. But on Rav Kook's deathbed, he repeated this. Do not separate from other Jews. Now, the anti-separatist ideology is an inheritance from his teacher, the Netziv. The Netziv has a responsum. He was asked in Galicia, you had this group called Machziki Hadas that wanted to follow the Hirschian approach and separate. And the Netziv writes that to separate from other Jews is as harsh as a dagger in our heart. He says, when we deal with each other, we battle, we fight, and, you know, in Mechale Shabbos, we can't be involved with them in certain things, but when we face the non-Jews, we face them as one community, unlike the Hirschian approach, where we become a new community. And as I said, we'll get back to this next class. In the interest of time, I don't want to deal with Rav Kook, I want to deal with Ratzvi Yehuda Kook and his followers. Now, as I said, as with the Haredim, Ratzvi Yehuda is exercised by the issue of Austrit. Ratzvi Yehuda has a whole reconstruction of what happened in Frankfurt. If you recall, there was a great rabbi from Würzburg, Rav Zalman Ber Bamberger, who opposed Hirsch's position and says you don't need to separate. As Ratzvi Yehuda tells the story, you have Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, who's a great sage, and Rav Zalman Ber Bamberger were both strong opponents of Austrit. Fact is, and I know Dr. Furziger, if I'm going to say you wrote about this, Ettlinger was not an opponent of Austerlitz. Okay, but leave that aside. There's no question that Bamberger said you don't have to separate. As we'll talk about in the next class, he wasn't actually an opponent. He didn't say that you have to be in one community, but you could be in one community. But as Rav Yehuda tells it, 11 families chose to separate from the general community. They bring in Hirsch. However, there are many great scholars, including a Rav named Moshe Mainz, who opposed Hirsch's step. And, of course, the Würzburger Rav opposed it, as Rav Yehuda says. And Rav Yehuda writes as follows, quote, "The followers of Rav Yitzhak Bamberger came to Hirsch and said, 'With all due respect, Rabbi Hirsch, you are not the equal of the Gaon of Würzburg in learning and poskim. You have to listen to the Psak Halacha of one of the Gedolei Hador. He does not have to listen to you.'" And there are numerous other texts in the school of Rav Tzvi Yehuda that are designed to show that Hirsch is not a Gadol. He writes nice commentaries on Chumash, on Tehillim, but you can't compare someone like that to the great sage, Rav Yitzhak Dov Bamberger, who was the leading Talmudic scholar of the time, all part of an effort to show that Hirsch is not a significant person, and we don't need to take him seriously. Rav Tzvi Yehuda goes so far, in his Netzivot Yisrael, to attribute the notion of Austerlitz to the harmful influence of the impure German environment. Let me just read, for those who do Hebrew, let me just read a few words. He says that only in such an environment could the terrible idea of Austerlitz come about. An environment full of Zuhamat Rishutam HaPra'it Vedat Evatam HaMeterefet L'Yisrael. Only in an environment which could give birth to such anti-Semitism, to Nazism, could such a terrible idea ever come about that Jews should be separated from one another. On and on and on. It's only in an impure place that could give birth to the rise of anti-Semitism and Nazism that such an ideology that Hirsch was so influenced by the phony, false Germanic notions. That's what gave him this idea. In other words, the idea of Austerlitz comes from Makom Tuma. It doesn't come from Tara. If you want to know Tara, then Rav Yehuda quotes, you have to look at the Netziv, who was Kuo Torah, Kuo Yirat Shamayim. Hirsch was influenced by the secular Germanic ideas. That's why it's a bifurcated Judaism. So the same thing Hirsch attacks the Rambam about being bifurcated Judaism, Rav Yehuda says that this is Germano-Judaism, not pure Judaism. Strong stuff. Rav Yehuda goes further. And in a letter, he writes to Agudas Yisrael. The Aguda invited him in 1955, as they invited his father, to come to the convention. And he writes them back saying, "I am absolutely not going to your convention. Your separatism has its basis in Kfira and will lead to more Kfira," he says. Again, strong stuff. One of Rav Yehuda's students, Rav Yosef Kellner, a leading figure in the Merkaz Harav school, he goes so far as to say, and this is really, I think, offensive, but he says it, that the negative effects of Hirsch's ruling on Austerlitz were such that mechila, that forgiveness, repentance, could only be found through poranut hakal, through the punishment of the kehila, and that is the Holocaust. So now here we have explanations, all sorts of explanations for the Holocaust. Now we have a new one. It was Austerlitz that Jews decided to separate from one another and not be a united people, therefore such a community. He's not saying in the sense that it's a punishment like God's punishing them, but such a community has no ability to stand. Such a community has no validity anymore if you're no longer one. And therefore, does it surprise us that now the Sitra Achra, the powers of the Goyim, can then triumph over you because you have chose to separate? Your job as Jews is to remain united. You chose to separate. That is not a kehila anymore. God only watches over kehilas that remain as valid kehilas, not those who choose to separate. But even Rav Tzvi Yehuda's school is not prepared to totally jettison Hirsch from the canon. Rav Yaakov Ariel, very important figure, probably the most important or one of the most important post-scheme and religious leaders and leaders of the religious Zionists, certainly the right-wing religious Zionist world, the Rav of Ramat Gan, the man who, if the Israeli chief rabbinate had any integrity left, would have been the chief rabbi. He writes that despite all this opposition we have to Hirsch's writings, we don't avoid him. We're not like the Haredim, he says. We don't avoid him entirely because although we reject him on Austerlitz and Zionism, there still is much good. We just have to decide what we take and what we don't take. Another interesting figure in the right-wing religious Zionist world is Rav Tau. The Merkaz Rav Yeshiva split, and now there's another very big yeshiva called Har Hamor, and their spiritual leader is Rav Tzvi Tau. He deals with another aspect of Hirsch. In the last few years, there was a whole movement in Israel, in the religious Zionist schools, to study Tanakh differently, to look realistically, to study it in a realistic way. That is, you look at the biblical figures, sort of like the Ramban, you know, the Ramban would point out errors, possible errors. Hirsch did this, and they look towards figures like the Ramban, and especially Hirsch. Hirsch said that when we look at biblical figures, we have to understand them realistically, because otherwise we can't relate to them. The big problem with this is, who are we to then look at King David and the rest and try to see them in a more realistic light? Problem is, Hirsch's justification of this analysis is a major stumbling block for those who oppose the realistic position. So what does Rav Tau do? He could have said, as the Haredi world would do about, let's say, a religious Zionist figure, no big deal, Hirsch is not part of the tradition. That's easy. Then you just jettison Hirsch, and there is no real authority, because you can't cite the Ramban. The answer to that is that, well, you're not the Ramban. If the Ramban could say it, you can't say it. But Hirsch is already in our own era. If he says it, it gives a hechsher. What Rav Tau says is that the moderns now, especially his anger is directed at, there's a place, Michalet, I think it's called Michalet Herzog, attached to Yeshiva Har Tzion, where they're very interested in doing this sort of thing. He feels compelled to argue that you're very different than Hirsch, because Hirsch approached Tanakh with a sense of holiness. And he thought that the only way to get across the sense of holiness in his generation was through a realistic portrayal. But the contemporary commentators, they lack this respect. They lack this love. They lack this closeness to the Bible's holiness. And Tau explains that even Hirsch knew that his approach was a time-bound one. Again, we get the Horat Shah angle. That in his generation, it was important to adopt this, to save the Jews from assimilation, from reform. But today, when we're back in the land of Israel, when we can have a pure approach to the biblical text, we no longer need to do that. Hirsch's approach, not only is it invalid for us, Hirsch himself would regard it as invalid because we are not in such a situation. So what we have here is both the Haredim and the religious Zionist community accept Hirsch, but none of them can accept Hirsch as Hirsch. He has to be accepted, updated, corrected to fit in with modern times, with the Haredim getting rid of the Torim Derech Eretz, and with the religious Zionists having to jettison the Auschwitz. What you're left with is you no longer have Hirsch, it seems. You have Hirsch updated and corrected. And with that, we have, 10 more minutes. If there's comments or questions.
What was the missing?
Okay. The question, well, was the missing tshuva was the one where W.T. Hoffman discusses taking the oath without a kippah, in which he talks about how in the schools in Germany, in Hirsch's school, and he mentions another school, they didn't wear a yarmulke.
Okay.
Dr. Judah.
In Hungary, they had the same separation. The Ksav Sofer and so on. What's the explanation there?
Yeah, I will talk next class. The only place where separatism took off, really, was in Hungary. The Chasam Sofer already speaks about if we could separate, we could. How would Ritzi Yehuda answer that? Ritzi Yehuda was a great lover of the Chasam Sofer, and it's a problem. Ritzi Yehuda is wrong. This idea that it comes from the Germanic culture is crazy. As you say correctly, in Hungary you had a much more complete separation. Germany, there were only four communities in all of Germany that were separatist. In Hungary, most of the Orthodox were members of separatist communities, and it came entirely internally. What Ritzi Yehuda believes is that this was a distortion of the Chasam Sofer, and that it's the same non-Jewish influence. But the Chasam Sofer has a tshuva there where he says, if we had the authority to separate completely from the reformers, we would be obligated to. So it's obvious that it comes from the Chasam Sofer. I think Ritzi Yehuda is wrong. Just like he's wrong about Yerav Yaakov Ettlinger, he's wrong about Zalman Baer Bamberger. He argues that Zalman Baer Bamberger was a philosophical opponent of Auschwitz. That is absolutely incorrect. He believed that in certain circumstances, Auschwitz would be warranted. But in this case, there's no obligation. But he also said there's no obligation to remain in the unified community. When Ritzi Yehuda originally published this, there's a German Orthodox scholar named David Henschke, and he wrote, I think it's like a 20-page article in the journal Hamayan, in which he takes apart Ritzi Yehuda point after point. But it's still ideologically. I know you're a Talmud of Ritzi Yehuda, but what can I say? He's wrong in this aspect. It didn't. Hirsch had strong reasons for this. Yeah.
So just jumping ahead today, is there an example, a modern example of the Hirschian approach anywhere today, as opposed to Hildesheimer?
Well, I'll hold off on it. In the next lecture, I'm going to talk about. I'll talk a little bit about what Austerlitz was, and then take it into the next generation, take it up to World War II in Germany, and take it post World War II and look at that. Yes, of course, it lives on. I'm sure you have it in this community as well. So we'll. I'll talk about that later. Yeah.
Okay. To Hirsch and, you know, evolution. If you want to make a comment, you know, Hirsch and evolution and how that plays out, and if you want to tie into the internet with the power of the internet, you know, it's a lot harder to falsify what somebody says now with, you know, in the Google world, and just how that plays into the whole educational system.
Yeah, I mean, Hirsch had interesting... it's impossible anymore to cover up these things. Now they're out there. Now Rabbi Kelman mentions Hirsch and evolution. Hirsch... I haven't seen what the attacks of Hirsch... They've tried to reinterpret it, but what he says is that we're not bound to any opposition to science. He wasn't a great lover of evolution because it hadn't been proven or anything, but he says that we could accept this. Very much like Rav Kook, we could accept this. We can make our tradition work with this. The argument has been, as I've seen it, if you look on Slifkin's website, is that that he really wasn't, that later on he changed his mind and he backtracked from that, but I don't see any evidence to it. Hirsch was a big believer that if it's scientifically true, it works with Torah. And we can't get up and say that Torah is opposed by definition to any form of science, because you never know what's going to be in the future. We don't accept all of science, just because some hypothesis comes around, but we always have to be open to the fact, and just like Rav Kook wrote about. But he's not a major figure in the science issue, Torah and science, but he is a major figure in the Agadic. If you have any doubts about this, go online and look at the discussion of Hirsch's letter. Hirsch is really the one to really elaborate this. We have the Gaonic comments and others, but the idea that Chazal are not interested in determining science. If, as I said, if some Greek explorer tells them that they discovered some species, they're going to determine the halachic aspects of it. The fact that they accept it is, why shouldn't they accept it? And Hirsch feels in this letter that it's actually a chil Hashem, and it's a danger to Judaism to say otherwise, because then you make a mockery of Judaism, because you assume that if everything is Torah Misinai and they were infallible and they understood this, then it makes a mockery, because then you see proof that the creatures that are described by Chazal are mythical creatures. And then someone's going to say, well, the Chazal were wrong on this, and everything's Sinai. Well, then Sinai's a joke. Reject all of Torah. Hirsch saves Judaism by saying, no, Chazal were great figures who dealt with every eventuality. They weren't concerned whether it was correct or not. You tell me there's such a creature? Okay, let's look at the halakhas about it. And for him, he sees that's giving the greatest honor to Torah. And the other way, and I think, by the way, it's been shown, if you look at the internet and the way these Gedolim have set themselves up and the Bizayon HaTorah, how they've been mocked, and made to seem like idiots, because how, if you have any education, you know, Chazal were told that there's a salamander, and you throw it into the fire. Well, you throw it into the fire, and what? You throw something in the fire, and a salamander is created. Who can believe this anymore? Hirsch's approach was the Chazal were told that there's such a creature. You throw it into the fire, and a salamander grows out of it. So, if there's such a creature, well, what's the status of this, Sheretz? But to say that you must believe this, that's just going to lead people away from Torah. And you've seen the mockery of so-called Gedolim and real Gedolim who insist that you must believe in this. Well, then what's... that? So Hirsch is very relevant in today, Dan. Yeah. Or mermaids, you know, there's another example. Yeah.
I'm not much of a scholar, but I have this hypothesis developing. And the first comment I want to make is, I think you might have had a Freudian slip and you said the 18 letters instead of the 19.
Yes, that would be
based on the fact that one was missing.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering what the connection is between these numbers and the Shemona Esrei. And my theory is that really Hirsch was a traditionalist. He was a man of his times. He saw what was happening around him. And his emphasis was Torah first, the rest later. And if I understood correctly, the reformers were also somewhat of traditionalists, but they put the reform first and the traditional second. And that's how he saved Judaism. And By the same token, in other parts of the world, Eastern Europe, for example, there was a different movement. Did not the Hasidic movement evolve to save Judaism from the reformers? And therefore, if we reject Hirsch because he was a man of his times, do we reject also Hasidism because it was a movement of its time?
Okay, well, but the Hasidim had nothing to do with the reformers. They evolved to save Judaism for certain problems they saw, but it certainly wasn't reformers. The difference between the Hasidim and Hirsch is that, and no one's rejecting Hirsch, that's my whole point, that everyone's accepting him, is that Hirsch wanted Jews to do something which they used to do, and as he says, in the days of Spain and the rest, and that is to bring, it doesn't mean to dilute Torah, it means to bring the insights of Torah into the world, face any civilization. The problem with Eastern Europe, Hirsch said, is that they thought that Torah is only for one civilization, the ghettoized civilization. No, no. Torah is for every civilization. When we're in the modern world, we don't build a ghetto. Torah's job is to work on every civilization, and in fact, it's better to be in an open civilization. We can bring our insights to bear, etc., etc. So that is a problematic notion for some people. It's much easier to be in the ghetto, and look it around. The Chasam Sofer knew what he was talking about. Assimilation didn't exist in the ghetto. It's much more of a challenge. On the other hand, you can't have any black and whites about this. There is no question that there is much more attrition in Eastern Europe, beginning in the early 1900s, than there was in the Frankfurt community. Once Hirsch got his orthodoxy going, and Germany became a Torah Derech Eretz place, there was very little attrition among the younger generation. And in Eastern Europe, enormous attrition. Many already pointed out in the early 1900s, if we had a Torah Derech Eretz in Eastern Europe, you would no longer have to have a choice between old-fashioned Hasidic Judaism and being in the modern world. That was Hirsch's great genius. It's not a choice. You don't have to be an old-fashioned Jew, be a merchant or a tailor, or be a modern person and go to the university and have a career. You can have it both. Judaism doesn't require you to make that choice.
Okay. We have time, I guess, for one more question or comment.
It's not a dilution of Torah.
Okay. No. Any questions?
Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll have lunch.